Well, good evening. It's good to see everyone here tonight. And our topic tonight, we're continuing our Tough Questions series. And our topic tonight is help. My spouse and I fight all the time. How to properly resolve conflict. Some people are clapping because they're like, yes, finally figure that out. But anyway, you'll notice that there are some pieces of paper and you can't come up yet. I'm supposed to introduce you. I've never had that happen before. It's like, gosh, you can't do that yet, Dr. Burby. So anyway, there's some piece of paper in the middle of your table with some pens, and please feel free to write all the questions. We're actually going to abbreviate some of the questions tonight, not ask so many beforehand, so that we can get into the Q&A. We'll collect those right before the last question. And we will go through them. I get to as many of them as we can. So feel free to do that once we start the discussion or at any point. And and we also have, there's the microphone right there, Aaron, if you could. Oh, okay. And I wanted to add just a, what Aaron called this, you want me to be Joe the plumber, don't you? And so this is Aaron Greer. He's one of our Sunday school teachers for off-road disciplines, and just a great guy. If you just hang around him for a while, you get tons of man points just for hanging around him. He operates heavy machinery and backhoes and tractors and dump trucks and all the cool things that you wanted to operate when you were a kid and still do as an adult. And you're living the dream. That's right. So it's great to have Aaron up here, and he's going to be helping do the interview. Well, tonight we have our special guest is Dr. Bob Burby, who is no stranger around here. He is he's been involved in several Sunday school classes for years around here, working with our young marrieds, our young couples. He is a counselor. He works for National Institute of Marriage and does a lot of other things that he's going to tell you a little bit more what he does, but we are honored to have him. This guy can help us sort it all out. He's another one of these individuals that you just want to sit down and have a great conversation with. So would you please put your hands together and welcome Dr. Bob Burby. Now you can come up.
All right. And I have to sit in the middle between
you. Yes, you do.
Wow. Okay. This looks dangerous.
Now, as a counselor, I should ask you, I'm not a counselor, but if I was, I would ask you, well, how does that make you feel, Dr. Bob, sitting in the middle?
Vulnerable.
Okay. Man, that's a great answer. Anyway, much better than mine. Oh, by the way, I forgot to say, happy Veterans Day to all of our veterans.
Amen.
And yeah. Are there any... shall I have all the veterans stand,
please,
perhaps?
Yeah,
let's have the veterans
good stand.
Yes. And right here, I'm going to make her stand. That's right. Awesome. Thank you guys so much. It's great to have you here. Well, when we come to the topic of relational conflict, this is not just for the individuals and the couples in this room that are married, because this is also for people who, are single and want to be married, or that just, relational and conflict principles really apply to many different aspects of relationships that we have in our lives. But we are going to be focusing in on the relationships that we have between spouse to spouse tonight. And so communication problems, things that happen, and marriage, Dr. Bob's going to help us out. Dr. Bob, like, you should have your... on show, you could. Well, Bob, real quick, just tell us a little bit about what you've been up to, and tell us a little bit about yourself. Some people may not be acquainted with you, and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, some of you, most people who've been here at the church a while have had a chance to meet many of you and consider many of you friends. What everyone may not know is I'm local to Springfield. I tell clients at National Institute of Marriage, if they come from all over the country and sometimes other parts of the world to work with us at NIM, and I said, if you looked at the map and saw that National Institute of Marriage was in the Ozarks and you were afraid that you were going to get stuck with some hillbilly shrink, Well, your worst nightmare has come true, because that would be me. I grew up here in Springfield. My parents are native to the area, and I don't live like a hillbilly, but I find myself thinking like one an awful lot. And so,
Aaron, can you relate? I'm just kidding.
I'm proud of my hillbilly heritage. But graduated from Evangel, did doctoral training out in California, and I've been a licensed psychologist for 24 years. Yeah, that doesn't hardly seem possible to be that long. Mary Jo, my wife, and I have been married 32 years. We have 4 children, some of whom you know, Aaron, Tyler, Allie, and Big Allie to your kids. Is it the Sutherland's kids? It's Big Allie. Yeah, Big Allie. And our youngest, Travis. So at National Institute of Marriage, my responsibilities are primarily leading an approach to working with couples who are in severe distress. Most of the couples that come to National Institute of Marriage we're the last stop before the divorce attorneys. In many cases, couples have already visited attorneys and have divorce papers in hand. They're just stopping in to see us before they actually sign the divorce decree. It's kind of affairs, all forms of infidelity, drifting apart, feeling like roommates, unresolvable conflict. We tend to see the folks who are kind of where their last stop. And we have just enjoyed a wonderful anointing and blessing of the Lord on what we do. And we just see some wonderful things happen. Our outcome research indicates that 94% of the couples who come to see us are still together within a year of having been to see us. And 84% are still together after 2 years. On two different measures of marriage satisfaction, couples show a significant positive change. Meaning the satisfaction they have with their marriage significantly improves on two different marriage satisfaction measures post intensive. So we're enjoying some wonderful success, and God's really blessed us. The program, there are 2 programs. One is a 2-day program. I'm actually going to be doing one tomorrow with it's 2 therapists with 1 couple for 2 days. And then there's a group program we call our Couples Intensive. And I'll be doing one of those on Monday that meets 4 days, Monday through Thursday, with a group of 5 couples and 2 therapists.
And if you'd like to know more about that, I'm sure Bob will
I've got some brochures on the table, and I've left some of my business cards for anyone who'd like more information.
Appreciate that so much. And we thank you for taking the time to fix all of us in a period of about half an hour tonight. So
certainly.
Thanks.
My pleasure.
Great. Well, when it comes to 2 people coming together in a marriage, oftentimes what we find is that things turn out to be much harder than what we expected. Maybe it's unrealistic expectations that you enter into a marriage with. Perhaps it's a situation where little things escalate into something much bigger. I mean, it could be something as small as the dishes that ends up being a major conflict point within a marriage. And the examples, we could just go on and on and on. But could you help us out with why does that start to break down in many marriages today? What causes the communication breakdown? Some people lash out, so they get angry, but other people seclude themselves, it's like the silence game, whatever.
Right.
And so could you help us out with what causes that? What ends up bringing any couple to that point where there's some sort of breakdown? By the way, if you are married, would you just raise your hand here in the room? Let's just get a quick poll. Okay, great.
Majority.
And if you've ever been in a fight, could you raise your hand? Okay, just so we know
we're among friends.
Exactly. So could you help us out with that a little bit?
Yeah. The cold hard reality is that marriage for many of us turns out to be a lot harder than we anticipated, as you just pointed out. every couple begins, every marriage begins with this promise. Sometimes it's made prior to a marriage proposal. I know with Mary Jo and I, probably the moment where we sort of pledged our exclusive dedication and commitment to one another happened probably 6 months before we were actually engaged, when we actually said out loud, "I love you." That was a big thing for us. And most couples, if you think about it, there was some moment where you made some promise, some declaration that you're going to be committed to this person for a lifetime, and it's going to be exclusive. You're saving the most vulnerable, most intimate parts of yourself for that one person. And it happens generally even before engagement. Engagement kind of moves, sort of solidifies it, and of course it's ritualized in a wedding ceremony where we exchange vows, we make promises. Most people kind of recognize that in a marriage, in a wedding ceremony, you make promises to one another, but as Christians, most of you would have included or understood that in your wedding ceremony, you were making promises to God. That they weren't just promises to this person, but you were making promises to God. And that's where we all get started, is this promise and this anticipation of moving in a direction that's going to result in this relationship where we get to enjoy the bliss of marital intimacy. And my favorite reference for understanding what was God's idea, what was his plan for marriage intimacy, is the end of Genesis chapter 2, the last verse. This is the chapter where God presents Eve. He puts Adam to sleep. He takes a rib. He presents Eve to Adam. And Adam has, you know, historical proclamation. Whoa, man. Yes. I'm glad you got it, Mike. And it's like, whoa, this is somebody just like me. The giraffes, that's interesting, but those lions are kind of scary. But this is somebody like me. Got bones like I do. Has flesh like I do. This is somebody I can really connect to. And the last verse is, the man and the woman were what? Y'all remember? Naked and unashamed. If you think of all the different ways that you could kind of consider that term naked, not just physical nakedness, but mental nakedness, my thoughts known and available to someone and theirs to me, emotional nakedness, spiritual nakedness, that my deepest longings emotionally, spiritually, mentally would be known by someone else and I would know them. And to know that in the context of such safety that I have no fear of judgment, no fear of condemnation, unashamed. That state of naked and unashamed, the kind of criticalness of that is amplified just a few verses later in chapter 3, where after Adam and Eve lose their innocence, they eat the fruit that gives them the knowledge of good and evil. What's the first thing that happens? Yeah. And we like know that we're vulnerable and we've been having trouble ever since. So essentially the breakdown in that from that promise has to do with how men and women manage that vulnerability, because we want it. We're desperate even to have that closeness, that intimacy, but it's so dadgum scary. And it can be just downright painful to take risks, become vulnerable, and then experience judgment, experience ridicule, criticism. I like to say that marriage is a terrible bliss. There is nobody walking the planet who has more power to bless me than Mary Jo. Nobody can touch me, encourage, affirm, embrace me like that woman can. And in the same moment, there is nobody who can cut me to the quick, who can injure or hurt me more than she can. So it's like that promise of bliss and terror all at the same time. Have I sufficiently creeped you out yet?
Yeah, for sure. I feel very vulnerable right now. Anyway, so I hear what you're saying, and it makes total sense. And I feel like what we do is we end up coming into a relationship with these promises. But then there is that realization of ultimately we all have that sin nature.
Right.
And so there's this gap.
Right.
Between the promises and the expectations and what some, you know, and then we're let down, you know, and then there's this gap of what we feel like is the perfect expectation and this sort of internal failure that we all
have. It's two things. I've failed. I realize I'm failing as a spouse, and I'm also very aware that they're failing too. You know, you're not being the person you promised you were going to be. You're not treating me. You're not loving me. You're not caring for me like you promised. I don't necessarily admit it, but I also recognize I'm failing too.
Could you talk to us about how, if we called that like gap management, so there's
right.
this gap,
right.
and there seems to be this thing that's almost cyclical in
yes.
our relationships. Could you help us understand
yeah,
how that...
Yeah, I brought a slide. If you want to bring up that second slide, the first one... Oh, there it is. Okay, good. Something that we call the fear cycle. Go ahead and hit the next button. And the next one. This is a diagram of the fear cycle that Mary Jo and I go through. Basically, what we've come to understand... in working with relationships now for decades, is that, and this isn't unique to National Institute of Marriage. There are other theoretical systems of understanding family relationships that use this model as well as us. We call it a fear cycle. Basically, all of us carry with us an internal set of what we might call buttons. There are insecurities, fears, anxieties, things that threaten us. And it's basically a threat to our self-esteem, okay? In my case, I am scared of being unimportant, I'm scared of being controlled, and I'm scared of failing. So when stuff happens in my relationship with Mary Jo that make it look like I'm going to fail, or it feels like she's trying to control me, or it looks like the dog and the kids, church, her missionettes group, everything else is more important than me, my sense of discomfort and threat starts to climb. It's like I can get kind of indignant inside and say, like, this isn't fair, you know, and I thought I was going to be her one and only, and that's kind of what starts running through my head. Mary Jo I think I have her permission. I have her general permission to share this with you. You want to get me in a lot of trouble, you go
ahead. I hope she doesn't think this is unfair.
Yeah, right.
That
right.
seems to be...
Mary Jo carries a similar set of buttons, but hers are unique to her. She's concerned about being a disappointment and things not being fair or feeling judged. So if something happens in the course of our life together where she senses that I'm disappointed with her or the kids are disappointed with her or people in general that she's been a disappointment, her sense of anxiety, her sense of threat starts to climb. If it looks like things aren't fair, that also starts to send her discomfort meter climbing. Or if she feels like she's being judged, that will do that. So you've got your own set of buttons. You may have some insight as to what they are. You may not. But pretty much, I mean, if you're a human being, you somewhere along the way, you've been disappointed, discouraged, not really been fully attended to and nurtured. And so there's some kind of sense of sensitivity that you carry within you. Now, what's interesting is that what people do, go ahead and hit the next button. And the next one. These are this is the other side of what we carry inside of us, the things that we really want and long for. So what happens, hit the next button, is that when these buttons get pushed, then I have some things that I do to react. I tend to get angry, pout. I am a gold medal pouter. I just challenge anyone here to a pouting duel. I'll give you a run for your money. And then I like to escape. I think television remotes are the most awesome invention in the whole entire world. To just kind of vegetate in front of the TV and push that, you know, the channel surfing button, that's like my escape. So when this stuff gets triggered, I'm inclined to react like this. Mary Jo also has some reactions. She might get defensive, try to fix things, or avoid. When this stuff gets triggered for her, this is where she goes. And these reactions tend to be like reflexes. I'm angry like that. I don't have to think about it. It's not like I sit down, let's see, I'm feeling really unimportant right now. I think I'll get angry. Yeah, no. It's like, ooh, the first thing I'm aware of is anger. I'm not even aware of this stuff until this stuff starts to happen most of the time. Now here's kind of the kind of pulling the layer back to what's going on with conflict, is that in each relationship, one person's reaction becomes, hit the next animation, hit the next button, becomes a perfect trigger for the spouse's buttons. They react, and then that triggers. So if you've ever noticed that conflict in relationships with people that you're close to has a sort of predictable, cyclical, repetitive pattern to it, this is what's going on. Doesn't matter where it starts. Somebody's button gets pushed, somebody reacts. And that, notice, if I'm angry, notice how that's going to slam into Mary Jo's sense of unfairness, judge. If I pout, she's like, that's not fair to be pouting. Right, okay. So that's going to slam into that. So then she does this. Look, if she goes in to fix it, what's that going to slam into for me?
Controlled.
Yeah. You're right on track. If she starts avoiding me, what is that going to slam into for me? My unimportant button. So we go just round and round and round and round and round. We call it a fear cycle. One woman in an intensive said to me, when she and her husband, their fear cycle was mapped out. We do this for couples when they come in to see us. She looked at it and her jaw dropped and she got just, that's a sucking, swirling vortex. I got the picture of a toilet bowl. You know, it's like when this is going, it's like you just get sucked into it and drawn down, and it just takes you for a ride and won't let you go. And so conflict, in one way or another, this is, I would suggest to you, what's going on under the surface.
Well, we should probably move into some solutions to get out of the fear cycle. And I'm going to pitch it down there to Aaron to ask a question. So,
well, we hear a lot of times about taking care of ourselves physically, emotionally, as a person, to be healthy for your spouse. How, as we as Christians, I'm supposed to love my wife as Christ loved the church, put her needs before my own. Where do we draw that line where I need to take care of myself, but yet I need to take care of her? Where do I stop taking care of her so I can take care of myself?
This is a, particularly for people of faith, this can be a real challenge because we, you know, and rightly so, we have been challenged not to put our own interests above others, and that if we take Jesus' example, who surrendered to the, submitted to the cross and submitted to that humiliation and that shame and that suffering, it, you know, how do you put that in perspective? Well, if I'm empty, I'm not going to have anything to give, and how do I get not empty so I have something to give? I mean, it just can be really confusing. The short answer to that question is that I would encourage you to do a thorough study of Jesus' life. Jesus is the best example of what taking good care of oneself looks like. Because we see in the Gospels, we see numerous examples of Jesus being so aware of who he was and what was necessary, what was a priority, that he never allowed anyone to make those priorities for him. He knew this so, he knew this at 12 years of age. You know the story, he's 12 years old, the family, what if they go to Jerusalem? I may get some of these particulars mixed up, but they go to Jerusalem. He goes into the temple, he's talking with the teachers of the law and the leaders in the local synagogue. The family's with a caravan, they load up. Oh, Jesus is around, he must be with family and friends. They take off. 3 days later, they realize, hey, where's Jesus? I thought you got Jesus. No, I thought you got him. No, you were supposed to make sure he got in the minivan. That wasn't my job, you know. That, and they realize that Jesus is not with them. They go back, and his parents begin to scold him, right? And what is Jesus' response? I must be about my Father's business. He knew at 12 years of age who he was, what he was about. And there are other examples, how he withdrew to the solitary places. When the disciples wanted to make sure that he ate, and he said, no, I've got food that you don't know about. You know, he was always in close contact with his well-being and his integrity. I would suggest that even his submission to the cross was not something so much an obligation. It's not like God held a gun to his head and said, you must do this. But it was the ultimate expression of who he was and the purpose for his being. So self-care or doing a good job of making sure I've got good well-being, I've got good integrity, that's all about being the person that God created me to be. Selfishness, I would suggest, is when I somehow make my well-being more important than everybody else. And selfishness is really an abandonment of self, if you think about it, because if I'm more important than you guys, then I got to get you serving me. I don't have to, it's your job to take care of me. It's not my job to take care of myself. That's what selfishness looks like. Being appropriately engaged and committed to my own well-being and integrity means I understand who I am in Christ and I am committed to that. In fact, I consider it to be maybe my ultimate commitment to the Lord is what am I doing with this treasure that he's placed within me? Of all the things that I'll be accountable for when I stand before Christ at judgment, somewhere near the top of the list is going to be, Bob, what did you do with that treasure that I gave you? What did you do with that life that I gave? Because my life, my very breath is from him. It's not mine. He's just given it to me to manage, to be a steward of. So if I abandon that in the name of quote unquote serving others, that's a little bit, what did Jesus say to the disciples? Be cautious about casting your pearls before swine. There's this deep thread that kind of gets overlooked in our zeal to be servants, to make sure that you value who you are in Christ, the value, the creation that you are at God's handiwork.
That's great. I never really thought about selfishness that way, but it makes it makes great sense. Now, another thing that I know Daisy and I have experienced in our marriage is that whenever we see some of these defense mechanisms come up and there's a sort of wall there. I know one thing that we've tried to practice, and it's not that it's difficult, but yet it helps us, and that is go back to that place where we stood at an altar and where we made this commitment to one another.
Right.
And you know, whenever I have my buttons are being pushed and I'm defense and I get this wall, you know, or I see the buttons being pushed in her life, and I realize that those buttons are just a reaction to something being pushed in, you know, that I am pushing in her life.
Right.
I am actually the factor that is causing that. And so, and then there's health on both parts and all this stuff, but this thought of loving the person behind behind those defense mechanisms, if you would, has really helped us in that, you know what, she's responding that way or I'm responding that way, but I have committed to love this person.
Right.
So it's this thing of, we kind of call it loving the person behind the wall.
Right.
You know, we
I like that.
We make this wall, and it's like, you know what? I know that's the wall. We know that we're being defensive right now, but I have made this choice to love the person that's even behind the wall. You're reacting by some reason or for whatever reason, who knows? Mm-hmm. But yet I love that person, and I'm not.
Well, notice the intention and the commitment, the discipline and the courage required to do that. That's all about integrity. That's all about you and Daisy being committed to having integrity before you even have a great marriage. You know, your integrity is the most powerful tool you have to changing this thing right here. To your integrity, there's no substitute for it. What is a great marriage but two great people? You know, and so you just can't go wrong by investing in your own integrity and well-being. There's we like to say that the well-being, this goes to your question, the well-being of the individual is in the best interest of everybody involved. The better Aaron is, the better guy, the more you're the man that God created you to be, the better husband you're going to be. What complicates things is our eyeballs go this way, okay?
Right.
So what I'm most conscious of in this fear cycle, unfortunately, is not this or even this, but this right here. Uh-huh. There she goes being defensive. Why can't she just leave it alone? Now she's walking away from me. You ought not to do that, Mary Jo. Come back here. You know, my eyeballs go this way, and so I ignore Jesus' words. And instead, and I want to take the speck out of her eye, ignoring the beam in my own, because this is what's most obvious to me. So to do what you are talking about, you and Daisy do, it means having a commitment to kind of that internal well-being and integrity, so that I'm going to be the man God created me to be, or the woman that God created me to be, regardless of how together Mary Jo has it or doesn't have it. Have you ever noticed how easy it is to justify all kinds of things when your spouse is being a jerk? I mean, you can justify almost anything. But how's that going to fly at judgment? Well, the reason I did that, Lord, was, I mean, did you see what she was doing? Is that going to fly? Of course not. Yeah, it's going to be about what was, you know, what was my behavior? Where was my focus? So the first insight about breaking this cycle is what not to do, because most people want to direct their change efforts this way. Speaking for myself, I first want to look at Mary Jo's reactions and say, okay, Mary Jo, you got to stop being defensive, quit trying to fix everything, and oh, by the way, don't walk away from me. Okay? If you'll do that, we'll be great. Okay, that's what many of us do. Even if I get enough insight to recognize, well, I guess I have some reactions too, I can kind of get focused here. Okay, I'm not going to be angry. I'm not going to be angry. I'm not going to be angry. You know, in AA, they call that white knuckling. You know, I might be successful at not being angry for a few hours or a couple of days. But that, you see, this is, like you said, this is just the symptom. The secret to breaking this is being more concerned about this stuff right here. And the way I do that is to really start with me. What's going on with me? I break the cycle by breaking this link here. And notice that's something I can do without Mary Jo's help. I think this is amazing if you think about it. This cycle that feels so out of control and so powerful to just take me places I don't want to go, that I've got all the power I need just within myself to break it by breaking it right here. The moment that I take a moment to take a deep breath, to examine my heart. Okay, we're getting in a spin here. What is going on? Well, I'm feeling unimportant, feeling controlled, and I'm afraid I'm about to fail, or I'm afraid I'm failing. That's what's going on with me. What do I need to do about that? I know what I'd like Mary Jo to do about it, but I don't really have control over that. As much as I might beg or plead, I don't ultimately have any power to make her do anything about that. But me, that's my stuff. I can do something about that. And when I start taking care of this, then I'm not so likely to do this, which means her buttons are not so likely to be pushed.
Before we go into our last question, I want to go ahead and get the Joel and some of the guys just to pick up any of the questions that you may have for Dr. Burby, and feel free to submit those. And if you could write both your names and your spouses, I'm just kidding. Don't you don't have to write your name on
them. We'll but, track you down.
Yeah, and you can submit those, and we'll go through them in just a second. But jumping back into this while they're collecting those questions, perhaps we could give a few handles, a few takeaways for people. And I don't want to jump to conclusions. I'll let you make those. But I would assume maybe a good place to start would be to have a meeting with yourself, you know?
And yeah, I love that. Yeah, that's exactly. That's what this, breaking this link right here, we call it, at NIM, we call it taking space. It's like a timeout internally. Sometimes it's a timeout with my, I say to Mary Jo, you know, I know we need to talk about this, but right now I'm so charged up that if we keep talking, I'm going to say something or do something that I regret later. I need some space. I need a timeout. So yeah, what did you call that? A meeting with myself?
I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
Sounds like avoidance.
Right. And on the, to her,
you could push a button.
You got it. Yeah. To her, it might look like avoidance, but there are two things that differentiate it. I love that question from avoidance. When people avoid, like when I'm doing my avoidance, I go to the TV and I veg. That's, I'm not doing any care of myself. I'm not doing any introspection, reflection on what's going on with me. Avoiders just want to avoid the pain. When you take space, you're leaning into the pain and you're taking a look at what is that about, where you're being curious about your own pain, about your own anxiety. That's the primary way it's different than avoidance, is that I'm working on me during that space. The second thing that makes it different is typically withdrawal, avoidance, escape, these different forms of withdrawal. The person never comes back to the issue. So when I say to Mary Jo, I need some space, I'm also saying when I get myself kind of together, I'll come back and we'll try again. When she sees me being consistent and disciplined about coming back, she's much more willing to cooperate and support me taking space, because I'm a better Bob when I come back after I've taken some space. So that what I'm doing in this space and coming back, that's what makes it different than just simple avoidance. Yeah.
So secondly, after the taking a time out for yourself or a right. meeting with yourself, and honestly, to take a look at what are some of the buttons, what pushes my buttons, and what
exactly.
makes me feel, what are my wants, or what makes me feel
yeah.
significant in this
right.
relationship.
Right.
You know, and I read one time, you know, if you're having a hard time doing that, just take the last month. When was the worst that you felt in the last month in that relationship, and when's the best that you felt, and what caused that? But then after you have that time out for yourself, obviously you should get together. How should a couple go about talking about these things
yeah,
in a healthy
yeah,
way?
Yeah. Well, an important distinction to make is when you're trying to resolve conflict, typically where couples want to start is they want to just find a solution. And sadly, that winds up complicating the process, and it actually winds up taking longer than it needs to. The place that you want to start is to try to understand this stuff here, the buttons, the fears and the wants that are underneath the conflict. Kind of connect emotionally about it, before you try to decide what to do. Connect before action. It would be a way to think about it. I want to connect with my spouse, try to be understood and understand, connect with her heart. She connects with me before we start coming up with a plan, solution, strategy. Most couples just dispense with the connecting part, and then they wonder 10 years or more later, why do we feel like roommates? Well, the reason you feel like roommates is because you made the solution more important than the connecting. And at the end of the day, the quality of relationship has much more to do with the quality of emotional connection between a husband and wife than it does whether you made the right decision here or the right decision there.
That's great. That's great. Thank you so much for that. Mm-hmm. And haven't you appreciated Dr. Burby's wisdom tonight? I thank you so much for saying that.
I feel like I'm talking really fast. I'm sorry.
It's a lot of stuff. It's like drinking water from a fire hose, but it's still good and refreshing nevertheless. So we're going to jump into our question and answer time, and I'm going to start, then I'm going to let Aaron take over the rest of them there. But this is a – you'll obviously understand why this is an important question and for us to address, and I'd like to for you to answer this. Where is the line between being a jerk and abuse? The follow-up question is, when should one leave?
Yeah. Well, maybe a short answer is I've kind of landed in a place where I don't think I would I just don't think it would ever be my place to tell somebody it's time to leave. That kind of choice and decision is so private, and so the consequence is so immense that even some of the most spun out, just volatile relationships that you can imagine, we're really, really, really cautious about. And I don't think I've. Yeah, I just don't say to somebody, you know, you really ought to go. You really ought to separate. We talk about the possibility, what the relative advantages, disadvantages of that choice might be. But the actual choice to do that, I think, it's really between the individual and the Lord. Because ultimately, you're not accountable to me. You're accountable, first of all, to God, yourself, and then this person that you made a lifelong promise with. That's where the accountability lies.
And before Aaron goes, can I just ask one follow-up question to that? I honestly don't know the answer to this question, but it'd be interesting from your perspective what it would be. The first part of their question, what's the difference between being a jerk and abuse? Could you help us for numbers of different reasons define abuse?
Yeah. Abuse... you know, from an academic or just kind of purely clinical definition, is when someone is imposing their will to where someone's rights to privacy, self-determination have been violated. Okay? So, I mean, that's sort of the clinical definition. The practical definition that I would recommend in a relationship is if my spouse is saying, I feel abused, that's all I need. If my spouse says, I feel abused in the relationship, we don't have to go any farther than that. Discussions about whether it's illegitimate to say I feel abused or not feel abused go nowhere. That's a sure invitation to the fear cycle. If Mary Jo says, I'm feeling abused, I'm throwing on the brakes. I'm saying, whoa, tell me more about that. I need to understand what that's about for you, and I want to care about that. Contrast that with, well, technically, what's the definition of abuse? You know, if she tells me I'm feeling abused and I want to debate with her about the dictionary definition of abuse, come on. You know, that gets us nowhere. If I'm really serious about being the spouse, being the person that God created me to be, it's not about debating whether she's that she feels abused. I want to understand that. Whether that would hold up in a court of law really does us nothing in terms of the relationship. So if somebody says, I feel abused, that's enough to pay big attention to that.
I'll ask two of these questions. I think they're pretty similar. But
sure.
How should one communicate with a spouse who adamantly has differing Christian views? And then what if neither person will give in because they both honestly believe they're right? How can one move forward?
This is where I'd like to go to. I think it's the next slide. Nope, the next one. I'm sorry. Yeah. Something that we recommend often to couples as a way of preserving the connection, the bond, the unity in a marriage is something we call a no-losers policy. Go ahead. Yeah, okay, it's up there. And that basically means that, and Mary Jo and I were fortunate, we, as students at Evangel University, we were a part, and as an engaged couple, we got to participate in an engaged couples forum, our premarital counseling, some folks that mentored us early in our relationship really helped instill in us this notion. We didn't call it 32 years ago a no-losers policy, but the principle, this ethic we followed, that if Mary Jo and I are not on the same page, then our relationship is threatened. So there's not a decision, a conflict, a solution to a problem that I'm going to feel good about and Mary Jo doesn't feel good about. In other words, if she feels like she's losing, we're both losing. If you're on the same team, you either win as a team or you lose as a team. If I feel like I'm losing, she's losing. And there have been a number of issues in our relationship, just speaking personally, over the years where we've had to communicate, talk, and work on an issue, sometimes for years. Issues, and they tend to land in some predictable areas. Things like money, how you're going to manage money. Stuff to do with parenting, in-laws, division of household responsibilities, sexual intimacy, personality differences. You pick any one or all of those, and these become kind of ripe areas for conflict. I challenge you, if you make the ethic to find a solution, whether it be about, you know, some Christian values and differences on values and principles and priorities, if you make the ethic to be, let's find a strategy and a direction that we can both feel good about. I mean, that has just saved us so many times. It's probably one of the most precious principles that we have followed in our marriage, and I see it making a big difference for couples all the time.
Maybe time for one more question, and then we will like to have you pray for us.
I'd be glad
if you would.
Yeah.
I think you answered both of these, but what if a spouse keeps some things secret? How do we deal with that?
Yeah, that's one of those hard ones.
That's why I ask it.
What's that?
That's why I asked it.
Yeah, this is about hard questions, isn't it? I think one of the hardest things about being married is when it looks or feels like my spouse has lost or is in the process of losing their integrity. They're doing stuff that they're not telling me about. They're backsliding. They're just not the person that I married. You know, what do you do with that? Because the painful reality is, much as I might see what's going on with them and want to help them, my reach only goes this far. And the thing that I think is so dangerous when you notice or you begin to see something changing in your spouse that is scary is to want to manage, to want to, in a sense, help them. One of the worst things you can do to your marriage is try to be your spouse's conscience. I mean, if you try to be Daisy's conscience, if you try to be your wife's conscience, I mean, just think about where that's going to go. All the energy that gets expended in trying to imagine and read their mind. What are they thinking? What did they do today while we were apart? And the surest way to go crazy is to try to control something you don't really have control of. To feel responsible for something that you really can't do anything about. And unfortunately, your spouse's integrity is one of those things. It's one of the hardest things about marriage that we see with couples that we're working with, because your intentions, the things that you want for the other person, are good. They're noble. They're legitimate things to want. Who doesn't want their spouse to be honest with them, to be open and disclosing and let me be a part of their life? We all want that. The cold, hard reality is my reach doesn't go that far, so I can't really control. And my experience is the more you try to climb the fence and get over in their yard and try to manage what's really in their yard, you've just left all the stuff that was in your own yard. And it sets the fear cycle in motion in a big way. What I will sometimes do is, when I'm concerned about something like that, and I always appreciate this when Mary Jo takes this posture with me, is invite a conversation. Are you open to talking about da-da-da-da-da, whatever it might be? If they say yes, well, that's an invitation, and I'm concerned about the can you help me understand? Take a posture of curiosity versus a posture of judgment. You know, do you know how long you were on the internet? What were you doing on the internet anyway? You know, if you assume, where is that going to go? If you take a posture of judgment with your spouse, you're just kicking into the fear cycle even before you start. If you can initiate from a place of respect, I know it's your yard, your internal life is your business. I appreciate access to it, but it's really yours. You respect that. And you approach with curiosity. Help me understand. This is what I'm seeing. This is what it looks like. How should I make sense of that? That, I think, gives you the best chance of being able to make a caring kind of connection and discussion of what that issue is. The challenge, though, for me, and I think for many of us, is when I reach the end of my reach, to stop there. To not climb that fence and try to get in their yard and manage. You know, I think you're on the internet too much, or you watch way too much TV, or, you know, that kind of trying to be your spouse's conscience. You can try it if you want to, but to quote Dr. Phil, how is that working for you? You know, I mean, really, how does that really work? I mean, if you think about it, if somebody changed because you were being their conscience, how much confidence would you have in that change in the first place? I mean, if you really got what you wanted, how would you ever know? Well, are they really cooperating because they've had a true change of heart, or are they just pacifying me? You'd always wonder about that. So again, if I can find the courage and the security within myself and my own relationship with God to stop short of trying to manage and monitor, then whatever change happens over there, I can have confidence that that's really them. It's not because I asked them to do this or asked them to do that. It's something that's really true and genuine. I love that question, because I think that's where many of us live and kind of bump into conflict, is that our spouse is doing something that, gosh, we'd like them to stop, or they're not doing something we want them to start. And we just can't quite reach it. We can't quite make it happen the way we'd like it to happen.
Thank you so much, Dr. Burby. Bob, would you pray for us tonight?
I'd love to pray for our relationships here in the room.
Thanks.
Heavenly Father, whenever I'm mindful and looking at the complexity of relationship dynamics. I'm reminded of just how ill-prepared and helpless I feel most of the time around these issues, Lord. As you, as was quoted in Psalm 73, we have no one in heaven but you. There's no one else. There's no one on earth that we can turn to. Our all truth and healing comes from you. And Lord, I would just pray in this moment that anyone in this room who is privately hurting, privately scared, privately concerned about the depth and quality of their marriage relationship and even relationships with other important people in their life, Father, I pray that you'd comfort them. You would somehow remind them that you are near and close, that you see, and that you are not afar off, but ready, willing, and able to minister hope, help, and encouragement and direction, Lord. I just thank you for this opportunity that we could just come together and think together about how our relationships could more effectively honor you so that we could enjoy all the blessing that you intend for marriage and family relationships. I pray that you would just give guidance and direction to each person present by your grace and mercy. In Jesus' name I pray.